The death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and how radio covered the event. That's our focus for this week on Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
On the American frontier with the Weston family and Daniel Boone in the exciting days following the American Revolution. We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead. The president died of a cerebral hemorrhage. All we know so far is that the president died at Warm Springs in Georgia.
The bulletin you just heard was in large part the dating standard for many people. Things became either before FDR or after. Adolescents in the United States on the afternoon of April 12, 1945 had not known any other president, as he was in that office for 12 years at that time. As the program being interrupted, the Wilderness Road over CBS was a kiddie show competing against other kiddie shows on the NBC Blue and Mutual networks. It was mostly America's children and eavesdropping parents who first heard the news at about 5:49 p.m. that Thursday. And the news was extremely shocking for all who had spent a large part of those 12 years covering FDR for radio news organizations. In fact, at the beginning of the Blue Network broadcast we're about to listen to an excerpt of, reporter Earl Godwin started a commentary, but was so overcome with emotion that he could not continue, and Hilmar Bocage quickly replaced him at the mic. The recording we're about to hear is a surviving disc from WENR, the Chicago radio station owned by the Blue Network at the time, and starts after commentator Raymond Graham Swing had taken over from Bocage.
When Mr. Roosevelt had piloted the nation, if not through victory, to within sight of victory, Lincoln's death removed him from leadership in the time of Reconstruction. President Roosevelt's death has removed him from the greatest task ever faced by men of making peace and building a secure and neighborly world. As in the case of Lincoln, the death of Mr. Roosevelt will silence the critics who have been vociferous against him as against no previous president save Jefferson. And he will appear to the nation in his true stature. He has been one of the greatest leaders of his country. He has been one of the greatest leaders of humanity. And his name will be lustrous as a lover of men, as a servant of their freedom, and as a wise and patient leader in the greatest war ever fought for freedom. His death will bring grief not only to this country, but wherever men prize freedom. It will bring a shock to all allied countries. For Roosevelt's leadership in the difficult test of allied cooperation has been the rock of their hopes, and his loss will be a weakening of allied coherence. Mr. Roosevelt had two qualities that fitted him for the great task of world responsibility. He had unbounded faith in the right, and he had unending patience. He was willing to take his steps slowly, but he never was willing to change their direction. Both gifts, which are the essence of his political genius, were needed in world affairs even more than in domestic affairs. It is natural that the accent tonight should be on loss, for President Roosevelt's death leaves a gap no man can fill. None in our political life has had his experience, his intimate knowledge of foreign affairs, or of the problems of our alliances. None has the peculiar combination of his qualities. We are weakened as a nation, and the good cause for which we have fought is weakened by his death. But it would be out of perspective to stress the loss in disregard for the fulfilled life for which we owe so great a gratitude. President Roosevelt's gift to his fellow Americans is not easy to appraise in a few words. He has served the country so long that he's become inseparable from the political scene itself. It's hard to realize that he was a man who felt like you and me, worked hard like you and me, tried his best, resented his critics, yearned for his rest time. He'd become an institution. He had been president so long that he had ceased almost to receive the normal response one gives to a human being. But from his entry to the White House which was in an hour of crisis, to his death, which was in an hour of infinitely greater crisis, he has led the nation steadily and always confidently. And in that time, he has revised the nation's concepts about human rights in this country. He has seen the law books enriched with a great volume of legislation designed to improve the lot of common people. He has impressed on this hemisphere his desire for friendliness and fellowship, and he has impressed that desire on all the world. It will be as a war leader that history will give him his highest rank. His clear eyes foresaw the approach of danger, and his deft and understanding leadership brought the country step by step through the decisions which lined us up on the side of democracy and civilization. Surely the most masterful skill he ever displayed publicly was in the period before Pearl Harbor, when he made the destroyer deal, presented the concept of lend-lease, wiped neutrality legislation off the books, placed our men on Iceland and at other bases, convoyed our munition ships to the British, and put our rising production on the side of those holding out against a dominant Hitler. Since that year, the crushing weight of war leadership has rested on his mind and his body. Anyone who had seen him recently knows how it bore down and sapped his rugged vitality. The photographs of him at Yalta showed him a tired old man. The return voyage rested him, and he seemed renewed again. And he'd been at Warm Springs, so his associates were sure he would be able to continue to bear his burdens. But today they were lifted from him, and he is at rest. But if he has left his burdens, he has left a heritage that promises to loom ever larger as he and his work are seen in historical perspective. It was a heritage wrought of his belief in common people. He trusted them. He loved them, and he served them. He fought for them as their commander-in-chief. He designed his vision of peace for them. And his leadership brought them more substantial benefits than is the leadership of any man of his age. If there is a peace for them in the era now opening, he will live on in it as the spirit of an artist lives in a masterpiece he has painted. If they maintain their security in this country, he will live on in that as a composer lives in the music he has written. And if they enjoy and enlarge their freedom, that will be the monument he would most have loved. Here is David Wills, who has just returned from the White House.
Over at the White House, the flag is at half-mast for a dead president. The silent crowds are beginning to line the sidewalks along the park, opposite the Pennsylvania Avenue entrance to the White House, but the sidewalk in front of the railings is once more guarded by military police. A few minutes ago, Steve Early, who for so long was the president's assistant and press secretary, and Dr. Ross McIntyre, told us how the news came suddenly from Warm Springs that the president had fainted at about 2 o'clock Eastern time today while he was having some sketches made but for a portrait. He'd been his usual self this morning, had gone about the normal business that he's allowed to do when he's resting at Warm Springs. He'd had no hidden illness, no operations during the past month to account for this sudden illness. But obviously the illness was serious. Dr. Howard Gruen, commander in the Navy attached to the president's staff, was with him, and Dr. James Polan of Atlanta was hurriedly summoned. At 4:30 this afternoon, Dr. Gruen in Warm Springs was talking to Dr. McIntyre in the White House and hurriedly cut off the call and called back in a few minutes to say that the president had passed away at 4:35. Of a terrible hemorrhage. At that time, Mrs. Roosevelt was at a meeting at the Salgrave Club in Washington, and Steve Early called her and asked her to come quickly to the White House. And in a few minutes, Dr. McIntyre and Steve Early told her what had happened. And when she'd composed herself, she said, I am more sorry for the people of the country and the world than I am for us. Steve Early had also asked the Vice President to come over quickly and quietly. The Vice President had been on his way to the Speaker's office. And when Harry Truman arrived, he was taken up to the second floor to Mrs. Roosevelt's sitting room, and she told him the news. The President had passed away. The Vice President So soon to be sworn in as president, asked at once, what can I do? And Mrs. Roosevelt turned the question back to him with, tell us what we can do. Is there any way we can help you? Afterwards, the vice president crossed from the residential rooms of the White House to the executive offices and met the cabinet to break the news to them. The Chief Justice was summoned, and as soon as he could arrive, was to swear in Harry Truman as President of the United States. The Secretary of State crossed in 2 minutes from the State Department. He will issue the proclamation of the President's death this evening. The Vice President, or rather the President, even Jonathan Daniels found it hard to switch so soon from Vice President to President Truman. The Vice President says he would rather not at the moment make any statement to the newsmen, but he intended to carry on as the President would have done. And for that reason, he was asking the cabinet to stay on the job. And that's a summons to the people as well as to the cabinet. We must finish the job in hand. We cannot leave the job until war is won and peace is secure. And as a symbol of the need to go on with the job just a few minutes ago, the State Department announced that there would be no change in the date of the San Francisco conference.
Warm Springs, Georgia is a small town between Atlanta and Columbus, a little closer to Columbus. It was from that little town that a CBS reporter interviewed several wire service reporters, all covering President Roosevelt on that visit, that particular evening.
This is Don Fisher speaking to you again from Warm Springs, Georgia. This small southern community, which has been linked often with the name of the late President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is wrapped tonight in the deepest shrouds of mourning. News of the humanitarian president's passing, which came so suddenly here this afternoon, has brought sincere grief to the hearts of these Georgians who had come to know him so well in his visits here during his tenure of the presidency. Here tonight is Mr. Fred Botts, registrar of the Warm Springs Foundation, a long acquaintance of Mr. Roosevelt's, who will express the feelings of those here in Warm Springs. Mr. Botts.
We, the patients, were inexpressibly shocked when hearing of our great leader's passing. Words are so futile at a time like this that we can only bow our heads, mingling our grief with the rest of the nation. Yet, we know it was and is his wish that we carry on and forward the great work he started here. He will still be our great inspiration. His spirit will live in our hearts always, as it did yesterday and the day before when he moved in our midst, guiding, directing, and cheerfully urging us on to overcome our infantile paralysis handicaps. We will prove our worth as his memory keeps company with our hearts. Hearts now wounded, but tomorrow strong in the faith to achieve the goal he set for us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Botts. Among the members of the press who were in Warm Springs today were the representatives of the three great wire services of America, Mr. Merriman Smith of the United Press, Mr. Harold Oliver of the Associated Press, and Mr. Robert Nixon of the International News Service. First, I'll call Mr. Merriman Smith over to the microphone. Mr. Smith is a past president of the White House Correspondents Association. Merriman, tell us about the occasion of the planned barbecue over at Mayor Allgorn's place this afternoon.
This was to have been a very happy day in the life of the president. He likes to be out with people. He likes to see new things. And this afternoon, on a small mountain just outside of Warm Springs, the mayor, Frank Alcorn, had a marvelous barbecue arranged. There were country fiddlers, and there were pigs and lambs roasting over an open pit, big stew pot full of Brunswick stew. The president was supposed to be there at 4:30. Everybody was up there, the citizens of Warm Springs, few that knew about it. They were up there in their Sunday best. Some members of the president's party were there, too, waiting around. The president was supposed to arrive at 4:30. And about that time, the party hadn't shown up, so we telephoned to the little White House switchboard and got a hurry call to get right over there. And then's when the world first knew the news that Franklin D. Roosevelt had died.
Well, Merriman, tell us this. The reading public in America and the listening public have heard a great deal about the news and radio conferences at the White House, and the president has always been described as being a very affable person at those conferences. It is true, isn't it, that he not only had a great deal of fun with the members of the press as they attended those conferences, but they rather looked forward to them themselves, didn't they?
As a matter of practical fact, Don, he was God's gift to newspapermen. He produced more copy over the period of years that he was in the White House than any president in history.
Well, thank you very much, Merriman. Now here's Mr. Harold Oliver of the Associated Press. Harold, how many campaigns have you covered with the president?
I covered his whole second campaign beginning in 1936 and part of his subsequent third and fourth campaigns.
And, of course, you got to know the president rather well, I imagine, in that space of time. What are, briefly, some of the highlights, some of the things that stand out in your mind as you covered those campaigns in 36 and 40 and now the most recent one in 44?
Well, the things that stood out in my mind more in the campaign travel was the hard trial on the physiques of those trying to keep up with the fast pace the president set. Especially that is true of the press service men who had to write 24 hours around the clock.
Well, there was quite a bit of mention last fall, if you remember, when he would get out in that open car on those cold days and ride through the city streets of Boston and New York to more or less enjoy seeing all the people along the parade route and have them enjoy seeing him too, isn't that right?
That is true, Don.
Well, what are the funeral plans as of right now, Harold?
The funeral plans, as we know them here, are very tentative and incomplete. However, we believe they have been announced in Washington, but so far as we know, they plan to take the body from here sometime tomorrow morning, probably beginning around 8 o'clock Central Time, which is on Warm Springs time.
And then they'll proceed on to
Washington. Proceed to Washington. It takes about 22 hours to get to Washington.
Well, thank you very much, Harold. I know that you, like all other newspaper and radio men, are rather sorry that this series of trips to Warm Springs seems to be nearing an end, because it's been a great pleasure to come down here to Warm Springs, not only to be in the president's party, but to mingle with the townspeople here.
Certainly.
Now, here's Bob Nixon of the International News Service. Bob, tell me, how has the president looked to you on this particular trip to Warm Springs?
Well, I'd rather preface it by saying this about Franklin Roosevelt. During the past 12 years, he has been called upon to bear burdens that perhaps no other man in history has ever had to bear. He bore up under them like perhaps no other man could bear. During the past year, he's failed rapidly. Coming down here from Washington on this trip, the president looked a little tired and worn. Perhaps no more so than he has for many months past. He had just come back, as you know, from the great conference at Yalta. He looked fine when he got back. He had had 2 weeks of beautiful sunshine on his voyage back home. And it's remarkable the recuperative powers that the president did have. At one time, he would look tired and worn. Then a few days of sunshine and rest, and he would look in great shape again. The past week or so, after his arrival here, he got out in the sun a great deal, and while he was thin and tired looking, his death today came very unexpectedly and a great shock to all.
I understand he used to get a great kick out of coming down to Warm Springs and after getting out of his railroad car, getting into his automobile and driving it on up to the foundation. Did he do that this trip?
He was a man who loved to do things and liked to do them himself. On this particular trip, mainly he drove around in an open car with his chauffeur.
What were his plans as to the San Francisco conference? I know he looked forward to going out there to officially open the conference. What were his plans, do you know? Was he going on to from Washington to San Francisco?
Yes, Don. One of the last things he did today before he died was to dictate the itinerary for his trip out to San Francisco. We were to leave here next week, stopping briefly in Washington and then continuing on out to San Francisco where he was to address the United Nations conference as the host.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented Mr. Fred Botts, Registrar of the Warm Springs Foundation, a long acquaintance of President Roosevelt's. We've also presented members of the three wire services, Mr. Merriman Smith of United Press, Mr. Bob Nixon of International News Service, and Mr. Harold Oliver, of the Associated Press. Thank you very much, gentlemen, all of you, for coming down to the microphone tonight to give the American listening public an inside view of just how things have been in Warm Springs today. This is Don Fisher speaking now, and I return you to New York.
Many working on the radio in Washington knew President Roosevelt personally, including three employees of the CBS-owned station there, WJSV, that we hear in this particular program. John Charles Daly, who had made the initial bulletin broadcast at the top of the program. Arthur Godfrey, who we will hear covering the funeral procession down Pennsylvania Avenue. And Robert Trout, who was called upon by the network to offer some personal observations about Mr. Roosevelt.
Tonight, the tributes are beginning to come in from the great and the small of the civilized world. There will be many sincere words of sorrow and respect, and there will be many tears, and most of them will come from the small, the unknown people, because, as another American wartime president, who also died before his task was done, once observed, there are so many more of the common people. Tonight, as the tributes and the recollections come in, it might not be out of place for me to add a few of my own recollections. Because I am a broadcaster, my memories of Franklin Roosevelt are almost exclusively concerned with the business of broadcasting. The president was known as an exceptionally able broadcaster. Many pages of prose were written analyzing his microphone style and technique, and students of politics have frequently attempted to evaluate the effect of Mr. Roosevelt's broadcasting talents on his political fortunes. But those whose business is not with broadcasting are not likely to remember that Franklin Roosevelt created much broadcasting history. He was the first world statesman to use the radio as a vital instrument of social power. He used it in a personalized fashion. His most famous talks were delivered in the style of an intimate conversation, which was enormously effective. He saw clearly the power of radio before many men in government had seen it. When Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as President of the United States for the first time, it was not the fashion of world statesmen to take their problems to the people simply and directly by speaking to the people, millions of them at once, over the radio. In these few short years, it has now become so much the fashion that it's taken for granted and scarcely remarked upon. For now it is the custom for the heads of the greatest nations to make their most important pronouncements to all the world at once by radio. The day after Franklin Roosevelt's first inauguration, on Sunday, the 5th of March, 1933, he broadcast his first fireside chat. Tomorrow, the 13th of April, 1945, he was scheduled to broadcast from Warm Springs. At that first fireside chat, and at many of the presidential broadcasts that followed, I had the opportunity of being with the president. As a representative of the Columbia Broadcasting System, I introduced a large number of the White House broadcasts and traveled with the presidential party through most of the states of the Union to handle the broadcasts outside the White House. From the beginning, it was plain that Franklin Roosevelt understood radio. He was interested in the technical equipment and in the intricate arrangements often necessary when he addressed the nation from remote places, such as a lodge high in the Rocky Mountains, or the parapet of a newly completed dam, or from his car of the presidential train. After he'd been in office only a few months, other statesmen, other men in politics, in foreign countries as well as the United States, showed that they were learning the lesson that radio is the natural method for a statesman to use in communicating directly with the people. President Roosevelt's approach to the microphone was extremely natural, although he had different styles which he used when speaking from his desk or when addressing the radio audience over the heads of a great visible audience in an auditorium or a stadium. I've seen him take the microphone at a college gathering, intending to speak a sentence or two of thanks for an honorary degree, and then suddenly, seized with inspiration, deliver an extemporaneous address lasting half an hour. And I've seen him, upon arriving too early at a political rally, stand patiently at the rostrum for 45 minutes before beginning his speech, until the scheduled time for the broadcast to start, and it was not easy for Franklin Roosevelt to stand. Once, as I was describing to Columbia's radio audience the approach of the president up the ramp to the speaker's platform at one of the largest political rallies of all, the braces on his legs gave way, and he fell. The pages of his manuscript were scattered. They were picked up by willing hands and hurriedly handed back to the president, who by that time had been seated, now within view of the visible audience of many thousands. He put the pages together again as best he could in the few moments before he was introduced. The manuscript was damp, crumpled, and spattered with mud. It was a tense moment, and Mr. Roosevelt did not falter. Only a handful of the thousands in the stadium that night had the faintest idea that anything at all had gone wrong. That was the night the president, in a strong and confident voice, proclaimed, "This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny." Many will remember that broadcast speech delivered at Franklin Field in Philadelphia at the end of the Democratic Convention of 1936. It was the president's acceptance speech for a second term nomination, and if he had allowed the accident to upset him, if he had become unnerved by the prospect that the braces might fail again while he was speaking, the political history of this nation might have been changed. He was not unnerved. If Franklin Roosevelt ever was, those of us who form the body of journalists, of radio and press, who have covered his activities, have not been aware of it. Customarily, his hand shook as he stood before the crowds which gathered so often in so many cities and villages, but there was no tremor in his voice. It was calm and confident by nature. It was calm that very first day, on March the 4th, 1933, when, a few minutes after he became president of the United States, he told the millions waiting by their radios so anxiously, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." It was strange for me to enter the White House the next night, that memorable Sunday, when the new president was to broadcast the proclamation closing the nation's banks. The first move in the hurried, exciting days that followed as the new government led the country in the struggle against the worst of all economic depressions. On that Sunday night, the White House corridors were still cluttered with baggage and packing cases. The first family of the land had not yet had time to unpack and move in. Later, a more or less permanent broadcasting studio was created in a small oval-shaped room on the ground floor of the White House, the diplomatic reception room. But on this first night, the microphones were set up in the Lincoln Study, a room which still clings to memories of the president who died before another war was won. Before broadcast time, Franklin Roosevelt sat calmly on a sofa talking to his old friend and advisor, Louis McHenry Howe, now dead. Earlier, there had been a business conference in the offices of Columbia's Washington Station, and as a result of that meeting, Stephen Early, the president's secretary, was asked by telephone what he thought of a title Columbia had thought of for the president's talk. The suggested title was Fireside Chat. A bit later, Mr. Early telephoned back that the president thought the title was grand. It expressed just the kind of talk he intended to make. But there in the Lincoln Study, a few minutes before the clock showed it was time for me to introduce to America for the first time the now famous phrase Fireside Chat, a few minutes before airtime, it was discovered that the manuscript for the first Fireside Chat was missing. A search was made for the missing speech amidst great excitement, but one man was not touched by the excitement, Mr. Roosevelt. He was unperturbed and seemed perfectly satisfied when someone found a mimeographed press copy of the speech. It was not so easy a copy to read, especially to so large an audience at a time so tense. But the president used that copy when he spoke. His cigarette in the long ivory holder burned down nearly to the end as he talked on the air. I watched it in strained fascination, for in those days in Washington, radio reporters were not used to statesmen who felt so thoroughly at home before a microphone that they could stamp out a cigarette in an ashtray while broadcasting without pausing or stumbling. Later, of course, we grew used to the president's ease of manner, and it was no surprise one summer night in the White House when Mr. Roosevelt's throat became dry as he spoke, to hear him casually interrupt his broadcast to ask for a glass of water, and after he had sipped it, say to the nationwide audience, "It's a hot night in Washington, my friends." Another night, the president exceeded his scheduled time on the air, and a clock on the mantel loudly chimed 10, which might have upset a broadcaster with less poise. But Franklin Roosevelt was not upset during that broadcast or any of the others when unplanned incidents occurred, such as on the night when his son James stepped without looking and fell over the president's wheelchair with a loud crash just as I'd finished the introduction and Mr. Roosevelt started to speak. Radio reporters, like me, were used to hearing the president call us by our first names and make little jokes at our expense. He loved to tease us about the speeches, as he would call them, speeches we were sometimes forced to make when for some reason there was more time on the air than had been scheduled to fill with words before the president began. And he often joked about the fireside chats on hot summer nights in Washington when a refrigerator would have been more comfortable than a fire. There were many strange and often moving sights to be seen on the presidential trips across the country year after year. From the beginning, the people came to see and to listen. When he could, the president spoke to them from the rear platform of his railroad car, which was equipped with a microphone. The baggage car of the presidential train carried the complicated microphone stand, which Columbia presented to Mr. Roosevelt on his first inauguration day, and which was used in the formal addresses at stops along the way. Often in the middle of the night, speeding through open farm country, or perhaps through the desert, some of the reporters aboard the train who had stayed up late would look out the window. And there, almost always, over the miles and through the days, were the silent crowds, farmers, shopkeepers, miners, fishermen, factory workers, desert rats. They rode in their battered cars or drove their horses or walked, for no one knows how many hours, to stand beside the tracks in the middle of the dark night and watch the president's train speed by. It seemed to satisfy them, as nearly as we could ever tell, just to stand there and look, or perhaps wave a handkerchief or a hat. Once in the rugged country of Idaho, we'd roared along in the train for many miles without seeing a house or a man. Suddenly, the train raced out from between the tall trees and ran beside a quiet mountain lake. There, on a tiny homemade pier beside his log cabin, stood a man, a trapper or a fisherman or a hunter, perhaps, standing on his little pier between two large American flags he'd rigged up, standing at attention with his hand in a military salute at his forehead as the train sped past. He'd made his arrangements, put up his decorations, and he greeted the train for the few moments it was visible to him. Millions of people all over the world will remember Franklin Roosevelt in some particular attitude or pose. Millions who've never seen him will keep in their minds the memory of his smile, perhaps, or his cheerful radio greeting, "My friend." Naturally, my own memory picture will be one in which Franklin Roosevelt was doing what I've seen him do so often, speaking into a microphone to all the people of this country and to all men of goodwill everywhere. There are many such mental pictures that come to me tonight. Perhaps it's not possible to choose deliberately the one I should prefer to remember. But if I am allowed a choice, I should like to remember always the Capitol steps in Washington, crowded with those who were tormented by worry, and the new president of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, saying to those people and to the millions beyond the Capitol at home by their radios, saying, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself."
Robert Trout, remembering President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the evening of the president's death, April 12, 1945. This is Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie. Interestingly, Columbia, or CBS as we know it today, had an arrangement with the British Broadcasting Corporation to allow its special correspondent, Alastair Cook, to use CBS facilities for his New York-based broadcasts back to his native land. It was from the Columbia building at 485 Madison Avenue in Midtown Manhattan that Cook shortwaved his first report on the president's death to London, and immediately afterwards, Columbia asked him to repeat it for its American audience.
Shortly after the news broke here today, Great Britain and the Empire heard the first direct news broadcast of the president's death from America. The British Broadcasting Corporation carried a broadcast by Alastair Cook, BBC's special correspondent in the United States. Mr. Cook is here at our CBS World News headquarters now to repeat that broadcast, the news of the president's death as it was first heard in Britain from America. Mr. Alastair Cook.
At 12 minutes to 6, the news ticker, tapping out a dispatch from Rome, about the British 8th Army crossing the Santerno River, paused after the letter R in river and waited. Then the bell rang. Once, twice, three times, five, and ceaselessly. There was a moment's silence, and there came a flash spelling out this stark, sickening sentence. Washington, President Roosevelt died this afternoon. That was only a little more than an hour ago by our time, but within minutes, the nation's radios had sent the unbelievable news to desert ranches and Florida's playgrounds and to the factories of the West and to every silent and crowded part of the land. A few minutes after that flash, I was out on the streets of New York. I walked across town towards Broadway and exchanged glances with hundreds of people who looked stonily back. You could only say the sentence over in your mind and feel chilled and empty. I walked through a long midtown street of early evening crowds going to the movies or home from work. I saw only one couple of young girls talking and smiling in a normal way. I asked them if they'd heard the news. They had not. One girl grabbed the other's arm and said, "Oh, my God," with a full, simple cry of emotion that any other day would have drawn a crowd and a policeman to move them on. Down in the flowered square of Rockefeller Plaza, strangers met in little knots. They looked sullen, and then, because there was nothing they could do, they drifted helplessly apart. And at once, in Washington, down there, the cabinet was being summoned suddenly from their desk and starting on an emergency cabinet meeting. Mrs. Roosevelt was giving out the simple announcement that the president had slept away down in Georgia and sending a message to each of her sons away in the fighting forces. Vice President Truman was being escorted by Secret Service men to the White House, an unassuming man from Missouri, suddenly become heir to majesty, as Calvin Coolidge and other small, unassuming men had been wakened in New England 22 years ago when Harding, as suddenly, died. In a drugstore in New York, a manager stood with folded arms while a band played music on a phonograph. A girl said, "You going to leave that music on?" The manager came to with a start and threw the switch, just as the great radio networks decided then to abandon for the time all entertainment programs. Some movie theater managers didn't know whether to go on with the evening show or not. Outside Radio City, a long queue, graver than any American queue could ever be, stood restlessly. One family broke away, and I saw the father make an impatient, impotent gesture with his hand and say, "It wouldn't mean a thing." While you saw all these simple, final things happening about you, the expression of a taxi driver, a student talking to share his feelings with somebody and missing his bus, the first women and soldiers and businessmen straggling into St. Patrick's Cathedral and going down on their knees, the official plans were being announced over the radio, spoken in a drone, in a vacuum of national emotion. It had been cerebral hemorrhage. The president had been ill 3 weeks. Mr. Truman had been on call for just so long. There would be a service on Saturday afternoon in the White House, and the funeral would be up on the solemn Hudson at Hyde Park, the president's home, on Sunday. But this was information to digest, items of curiosity that had little meaning to an emotional and inquisitive people who now had their fill of emotion and no longer any need of inquisitiveness or curiosity. As I came back to say these things to you, a group of businessmen halted at the foot of an elevator shaft. They had exchanged jokes for years about little boys who thought there never had been another president and never would be, who thought that Roosevelt was immortal. In a way, the businessmen had thought so themselves, and now they knew that he was.
That was Alistair Cook.
In return, on the following day, April the 13th, the BBC shortwaved the following report by Mrs. Dora Bateman, a BBC commentator, to local stations in the United States. This is the report she sent to WLS in Chicago.
This is London calling North America. Next in our program, we present a talk by Mrs. Dora Bateman. At 19 hours and 30 seconds, 30 and 30 seconds precisely. Stand by now for Mrs. Dora Bateman.
to you, listeners, to station WLS. This is Dora Beachman speaking to you from a BBC studio in London. I really don't know how to express the horrible shock I had on listening to the 7 o'clock news this morning to hear of the death of Mr. Roosevelt. It seems like a personal loss, and I'm sure we English feel it almost as much as if it had been our own leader. He was such a fine man, an outstanding example of how a person could triumph over physical disability, given the will and the courage. To have worked so hard and so long for victory, and then to be taken as it is in sight, is indeed tragic. Coming up to town today, there was an air of gloom and sadness on everyone's face, replacing the brightness that the news of the last few weeks has caused. I think everyone in England liked and respected Mr. Roosevelt, and personally, I've never heard a soul speak an unkind word about him. He seemed to be appreciated by all as a really sincere, good-living man. I've heard a great many British women, too, expressing their deep sympathy with Mrs. Roosevelt. We haven't forgotten her visit to Britain last summer and her friendly interest in the different parts played by British women and girls at war. She must understand so well the feelings of mothers everywhere who watch their boys and girls put on uniform and march off to war, going away from home, perhaps for the first time, to live and fight in strange surroundings, doing things their mothers can't follow even in imagination. You know, I sometimes think that that's one of the hardest things to bear. I found it so with my own husband during the last war. I couldn't follow him even with my mind, because the experiences he was going through were quite outside anything I'd ever known. We British mothers know how you in the United States must feel with your boys over here in countries you've only read about, among people you know nothing of. Your letters tell me over and over again of your anxiety for them. And I'd like to assure you once again that in Britain at least we are doing all we can to welcome them. Just lately, though, many homes in Britain have been gladdened by one piece of news in particular, the overrunning by British and American forces of prisoner of war camps. Already, some of the boys are coming home again. Those who were taken prisoner at Arnhem are liberated, and this week they arrived back in Britain. They had terrible stories to tell of their forced march of 400 miles eastward into Germany as our soldiers advanced. But all through it, they realized that before very long they would be free again, and that helped to keep their spirits up. The other night, we heard a young Canadian airman speaking on the radio. He had been a prisoner of the Germans for more than 5 years, and the free world seemed a little strange to him. I can imagine how his mother will feel when he walks through the front door of his home again. I think it's so important, don't you, to keep the home going for these boys and girls. Home is the place they dream of while on the way. If ever I ask one of them what is the first thing he wants after the fighting is over, I know what the answer will be in advance. First of all, to go home. I think the women who go on cheerfully with their daily life in spite of all their worries and fears are the bravest people on earth. And now this is Dora Bateman from the BBC in London returning you to station WLS Chicago.
You just had a talk by Mrs. Dora Bateman, presented from London by the BBC.
President Roosevelt had been scheduled to broadcast a speech, one he was particularly proud of, on the evening of April the 13th, Jefferson Day. In April of 1995, just before the 50th anniversary of Roosevelt's death, Chicago radio station WNIB acquired a copy of that undelivered speech, and had announcer Ken Alexander deliver it in much the same fashion that FDR would have. This is the recording of Alexander's recitation.
Americans are gathered together this evening in communities all over the country to pay tribute to the living memory of Thomas Jefferson, one of the greatest of all Democrats. and I want to make it clear that I am spelling the word Democrats with a small d. I wish I had the power, just for this evening, to be present at all of these gatherings. In this historic year, more than ever before, we do well to consider the character of Thomas Jefferson as an American citizen of the world, as minister to France, then as our first Secretary of State, and as our third president. Jefferson was instrumental in the establishment of the United States as a vital factor in international affairs. It was he who first sent our Navy into far distant waters to defend our rights. And the promulgation of the Monroe Doctrine was the logical development of Jefferson's far-seeing foreign policy. Today, this nation which Jefferson helped so greatly to build is playing a tremendous part in the battle for the rights of man all over the world. Today, we are part of the vast Allied force, a force composed of flesh and blood and steel and spirit, which is today destroying the makers of war, the breeders of hatred, in Europe and in Asia. In Jefferson's time, our Navy consisted of only a handful of frigates, headed by the gallant USS Constitution, old Ironsides. But that tiny Navy taught nations across the Atlantic that piracy in the Mediterranean, acts of aggression against peaceful commerce and the enslavement of their crews, was one of those things which among neighbors simply was not done. Today, we have learned in the agony of war that great power involves great responsibility. Today, we can no more escape the consequences of German and Japanese aggression than could we avoid the consequences of attacks by the Barbary Corsairs a century and a half before. We, as Americans, do not choose to deny our responsibility, nor do we intend to abandon our determination that within the lives of our children's children, there will not be a third world war. We seek peace, enduring peace. More than an end to war, we want an end to the beginnings of all wars. Yes, an end to this brutal, inhuman, and thoroughly impractical method of settling the differences between governments. The once powerful, malignant Nazi state is crumbling. The Japanese warlords are receiving in their own homeland the retribution for which they asked when they attacked Pearl Harbor. But the mere conquest of our enemies is not enough. We must go on to do all in our power to conquer the doubts and the fears, the ignorance and the greed which made this horror possible. Thomas Jefferson, himself a distinguished scientist, once spoke of the brotherly spirit of science, which unites into one family all its votaries of whatever grade and however widely dispersed throughout the different quarters of the globe. Today, science has brought all the different quarters of the globe so close together that it is impossible to isolate them one from another. Today, we are faced with the preeminent fact that if civilization is to survive, we must cultivate the science of human relationships, the ability of all peoples, of all kinds, to live together and work together, in the same world, at peace. Let me assure you that my hand is the steadier for the work that is to be done, that I move more firmly into the task, knowing that you, millions and millions of you, are joined with me in the resolve to make this work endure. The work, my friends, is peace. More than an end of this war, an end to the beginnings of all wars. Yes, an end forever to this impractical, unrealistic settlement of the differences between governments by the mass killing of peoples. Today, as we move against the terrible scourge of war, as we go forward toward the greatest contribution that any generation of human beings can make in this world, the contribution of lasting peace, I ask you to keep up your faith. I measure the sound, solid achievement that can be made at this time by the straight edge of your own confidence and your resolve. And to you, and to all Americans who dedicate themselves with us to the making of an abiding peace, I say, the only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. Let us move forward with strong and active faith.
For its coverage of the funeral procession down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, Columbia had asked Arthur Godfrey, who had been a personal favorite of both President and Eleanor Roosevelt for years as the morning disc jockey on WJSV. At the end of his long career over the CBS radio network on the 30th of April, 1972, Godfrey reflected on several events in his career, closing with the Roosevelt funeral procession that had brought him his first truly great national fame.
But there's one thing that I would like for you to hear as we leave. The last thing I want you to hear is the promise that I'll tell you the whole story someday, because it is a beautiful one. And from it, somebody might learn something, so maybe I'll try to tell it. I had planned today to play with Remo and Jean an arrangement that Remo made for me that I have mastered. That is to say, I can do it once in 12 times, I'll get it right. Remo, you know, who, when he first joined this little orchestra 27 years ago, had just recently won the Esquire magazine poll twice, I think, for leading guitar, jazz guitar in America. And he's taken all this time to try to teach me. But I don't have time to do that here. Maybe someday we'll do it again for you on TV. But there is one thing I want to leave with you. In 1945, we lost President Roosevelt. And I was asked, as I often had been in those days, by the network to cover the funeral. And I was often asked to do little pieces of what they used to call public events. And this is the thing, this description that I did has become famous. The late Ed Murrow included it in a record of his called Hear It Now. And everybody thinks that it was great. I myself was so ashamed of having broken down in it that I vowed I would never again do any public events, that I was not a reporter. I couldn't be objective. I had to get emotionally involved, and that was no good in our business. And so it changed the whole career. But I think it belongs here. It was the big event in 1945. Remember on the record how it goes?
He had gone down Pennsylvania Avenue many times before. This was his last trip to the White House. A city watched, a nation listened. Arthur Godfrey, an old Washington hand, described it.
The drums are wrapped in black crepe and are muffled, as you can hear. And the pace of the musicians is so slow. And behind them, these are Navy boys. And now just coming past the treasury, I can see the horses drawing the caisson. And most generally, folks having as tough a time as I am trying to see it. And behind us, is the car bearing the men on whose shoulders now falls the terrific burdens and responsibilities that were handled so well by the men to whose body we're paying our last respects now. God bless him, President Truman. We return you now to the studio. It broke me up because I had known the late president very well. And I decided that day that I must never again try to do that, because I'm one of those people who cannot be objective. I get deeply personally involved in everything.
Arthur Godfrey recalling Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005, produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.